Live from Burbank, California, where dialogues are welcomed but conditions rejected. It's the Mark Maron Show. And now, he can't say nuclear. Mark Maron.
I know you've used that one before. That's the second time you used that one, man.
Not in the opening.
And there's a joke story that's 4 days old. The whole thing's going down the crapper, Earl. Good evening, geniuses, philosopher, kings and queens, working class heroes, progressive utopians with no sense of humor, lurking conservatives, pain sponges, need machines, bloggers. Man, I spent the entire day burning flags because we got to take advantage of that freedom before they take it away. Jim, did you burn your flag today?
Only after I used it to wipe my excrement off my bottom.
Oh, good for you. So you got the smaller flags you can just wipe your butt with. That's great, man.
That's right.
Yeah, did you feel free when you did that? Did you say, yeah, man, I'm free. Look at that. I'm thinking about giving Mortensen some flags to blow his nose today.
Oh, great.
Yeah, I've got some flag hankies he can use.
I'm sure he'd appreciate it. They're very rough.
Those idiots, those dumb Republicans, those monkeys, they're just bringing this up to politicize an issue, to get jingoistic, to get the blood up in what's left of their base as we head towards the July 4th weekend. They're just trying to lob this on. This has nothing to do with nothing.
Why should we take the American flag seriously when Six Flags Magic Mountain has the Confederate flag as one of the six flags all around the country? I mean,
don't they still have the KKK ride, or is that
KKK great?
Yeah, the where you put on a hood and you get on the little car and everybody gets you get a burning cross and you go through the halls of hanging black people. Do they still have that
log
at Six Flags?
Jam right into the big thing of fire.
Well, I mean, that flag has caused more problems. I mean, that flag is actually represents, you know, despite whatever Southern pride people may have, it is a racist emblem, a symbol of American shame.
Oh, it's a symbol of their screwing up Reconstruction and us, the North, footing the bill for the Civil War.
We still foot the bill for a lot of those states. You know that, don't you?
That's right. We should cut it off.
The blue
right
states are paying the bulk of the taxes to carry those horrendous red states.
Texas, if you're a republic, then live alone. That's what I say.
Speaking of Texas, that fella Tom DeLay, who resigned as House Majority Leader, is up to some shenanigans. Apparently, he is on the ballot as the candidate in his district for Congress come November. He's on the ballot. He can't not be on the ballot unless he is declared ineligible. And the only way that he can be ineligible is if he doesn't live in the state anymore. Now, he declared his candidacy while he lived in the state. So constitutionally, apparently, he can be held to that. But he's trying to cut and run and go to Virginia, where he's got a condo, and declare residency there by getting a hunting license and a fishing license. Now, the reason this is coming up is the Democrats are in a hearing before a federal judge are saying, look, you know, he's the guy. Because why wouldn't they want to run against Tom DeLay? He's indicted. He's an indicted criminal.
He has a chance in Virginia?
No, it's not that he has a chance. It's just this is a problem for them.
He's the guy they want to run against.
Yeah, because even if he's not running, even if there's another candidate, if he's the primary candidate, this is how I understand it. I might be missing the whole boat on this because some of the language on these type of stories, it just eludes me in terms of understanding it. The Democratic Party says that eligibility for Congress is established by the U.S. Constitution. Under its guidelines, a person is only required to be an inhabitant of the state on election day to be eligible for Congress. State residency requirements cannot be used to determine eligibility. The Democrats contend when Tom DeLay filed for office, he swore that he would be an inhabitant of Texas on election day. And he's trying to, apparently he went to Virginia, he got these hunting and fishing licenses, said, I live here now. So they can support another candidate, but the Democrats are trying to hold him to being the candidate. That's a pretty clever little scheme, but I don't think he's going to get away with it, apparently. It might not work out for him. He might actually be on the ticket. Now, this story that you brought to my attention, I think, is a sad indication of the future for many people.
Hell yeah.
The American Bankers Association, in a quarterly survey of consumer loans, reported today that the percentage of credit card payments 30 or more days past due increased to 4.40% in January. That's in the quarter. That is up from 4.27% in the closing quarter of last year. This means more people are unable to pay their debt to credit card companies, which means they will keep going up, the interest will keep compounding, and if these people get into more trouble than they're already in because of the way the bankruptcy laws are structured now because of legislation put through by this ridiculous House and Senate, they are unable to declare personal bankruptcy.
And that this parallels a similar story of people defaulting on their home loans left and right.
Yeah, that's another big problem. And also the primary problem at the core of all this is essentially that the working wage is not enough for people to keep their head above water. And, of course, those are the people that are most likely to get into damaging debt are people that really can't afford to survive in this world on what they're being paid.
And they live off of credit cards like MBNA, which it, for some reason it can break the law every month. It breaks the law millions of times every month by telling you and you and me and other people like me that, hey, you know what, you're – your interest payment just changed, and also the amount we agreed on that you pay every month just changed, and also the time of month that you pay we arbitrarily changed in the contract that you signed. They signed also, but for some reason they are not, you know, held by a written contract.
Right. That's because they write the rules, and they are supported by the rules by the politicians they own there in Maryland.
But you know, if the average Joe had enough money to take that MBNA to court and say, look, you violated this contract in a giant class action suit, then maybe something would happen. But the cards are stacked against them.
They're all stacked against them. And the real scary thing is what you were talking about before we went on the air, is that if it comes down to it, unable to declare bankruptcy and completely in debt, that the credit card companies, through the bankruptcy courts, can put a lien on everything you make and start taking your crap and ruin your life. And the sad thing is that most of these people that get into these kind of problems don't have health coverage either. And even people with a medium means, even people that are making 40 G's a year, who don't have health coverage, are literally one illness away from complete bankruptcy. And a lot of people pay their medical bills with credit cards. A lot of people, it's not just with gas prices and energy prices escalating, but a lot of the costs, a lot of the people are stringing this stuff along for the basic necessities of life. And that's what they're going to be penalized for. The credit card companies try to make it out like these big spenders, these people are wasting money, they're buying stuff they can't afford, that's what it is. But the truth of the matter is, a lot of these people that are getting into this kind of trouble are people that are using credit cards just to survive, eat, and maybe pay for some medical coverage for themselves and fuel their car so they can go to work and make an unfair wage. Harry Reid today, Senator Harry Reid, said he is going to stand in the way of passing the pay hike for Congress if they don't agree to do something about this minimum wage.
Because it gets in the way of the Republicans and conservatives' ultimate goal, which is wage slavery, a debt slavery in this country, you know, tantamount to 19th century Russian serfdom, where people, you know, they were enslaved on a little patch of land that they had to pay the person renting to them, you know.
Yeah, but this, they don't even get the land here. They don't even get that.
Not anymore, but you know, it's going to turn into that.
Yeah, well, it already is that. And this is a very disturbing situation coming out of New Orleans as well. We're not being very upbeat in the first segment of our show, and we certainly have to get into who's going to be on the show. But a lawsuit was filed against the U.S. Housing and Urban Development Secretary Alfonso Jackson and the Housing Authority of New Orleans on behalf of public housing residents in the United States District Court in New Orleans, because basically housing and urban development is going to keep all those people that lived in projects, yeah, all the black families, primarily black families, lower income families who are in public housing, cannot return to New Orleans by design. By design, you're looking at thousands. You're looking at about 5,000 public housing units that are going to be demolished, okay? And that's about 5,146 displaced, predominantly African-American families that were living in these places cannot return to New Orleans. This is almost an ethnic cleansing of the city of New Orleans by developers in cahoots with the Housing and Urban Development Secretary Alfonso Jackson. And they're not ashamed of it. They've been trying to get rid of these people for years.
It's urban renewal to them.
Yeah, it's strip mining urban renewal. But they are shameless about it, and it's a tragedy because it's just like New York. There was a time where if you lived in New York City and you worked in New York City in one of the lower echelons of employment, that there was rent-stabilized apartments that you could live in. That was one of the great things about New York City, is that everybody from all economic statuses could live on the island somewhere and be able to go to work without, you know, spending a lot of money or commuting from New Jersey. But that was what was a marvel about it, that there was rent control, rent stabilization. So there was such a diversity of income levels and the type of people that lived there, like the doormen who worked in one building, you know, lived downtown in another building. Mm-hmm. But now that is all done because they legislated away almost all the rent stabilization, almost all the rent control. And now you've got to be a millionaire to afford to live on New York City. So all that diversity and all that that sort of melting pot energy is completely gone from the island of Manhattan. It's obviously a very different situation. This is really just, you know, pushing the poor out. And just like you said, just like indentured servitude, where the hell are these people going to go? These 5,000 people should have had an opportunity to help rebuild their city, to be part of it, to be part of the legacy of that city. And now they're just gone. Where the hell do they go?
They're going to the next miracle renaissance town of North America, Los Angeles.
They're coming out here?
You know, the city of Los Angeles is suing a conglomerate of landlords who are trying to kick out rent-stabilized people. You don't hear about that in New York ever.
They all try to do that eventually, man. They you do hear about it. People fight it all the time in New York. Hey, we'll be coming back in a minute with Jonathan Alter from Newsweek magazine to talk about the cut-and-run frame. Talk about cut-and-run. Republicans do it all the time with money. With money. We've also got Michael Walker, author of Laurel Canyon, the inside story of rock and roll's legendary neighborhood, and, very excited, Andrea Du, co-author of Insurgents, Terrorists, and Militias, The Warriors of Contemporary Combat, and Mort Mortensen. Stay tuned.
His new gardener is Boy George, Mark Maron.
Boy George, does a duet with Anthony and the Johnsons, who I'm sort of listening to these days. I'm kind of feel a little weird about listening to it. Jonathan Alter is a columnist for Newsweek magazine. He covers media, politics, international affairs. He does it all. He has covered the last six presidential campaigns for Newsweek. He frequently interviews American presidents and other world leaders. He's authored more than 50 Newsweek cover stories. He's also the author of the new book, The Defining Moment, FDR's Defining Moment and the Triumph of Hope. In his latest piece, he talks about the new frame the Republicans are using to try to make the Democrats look like a bunch of yellow-bellied surrender monkeys. Welcome to the show, Jonathan Alter.
Thanks very much.
So cut and run, is it sticking? And can the Dems get it off of them?
That's a great question. I think it is sticking, but that doesn't mean it has to. That cut and run has to cut and make them bleed. If they can blunt it by explaining that we're talking about a unified Republican Party that's unified behind a failed policy and a fiasco in Iraq. And as long as they're not scared away from dealing with the issue by cut and run, we'll be fine. But, you know, my concern for the Democrats is that they're just kind of wimpy about engaging on the issue of Iraq, whatever their position is, whether they're whether they're for a timetable or not, they need to make it clear that it's not really about them. It's not really about the Democrats. It's about the Republicans. They control the government. The Democratic position is basically irrelevant. They have no power to do anything.
Right.
So the point is that this should be a referendum on Bush's Iraq policy. If you think it's a good policy and Iraq is a success, vote Republican. If you think it's a failure, vote Democratic.
Well, it seems that they should also have a Senate representative or a congressional representative other than Congressman Murtha out there on a weekly basis just saying, hey, let's give an Iraq report. Let's look at what happened in all the provinces. How many U.S. soldiers were killed? How many Iraqi soldiers were killed? How many civilians were killed? Let's just look at that on a week-to-week basis and gauge it on how much it's gone up and what's really happening on the ground. And it would seem that just that information in and of itself would prove your point.
I think that's actually a very good idea. They're afraid to do that because they think that you know, reflects badly on the troops or something. It doesn't. It's just legitimate criticism of a failed policy.
Well,
they have to stop getting scared into thinking that somehow they're going to look anti-war or, you know, anti-American or unpatriotic if they just say, look, we're holding the president accountable for a failed policy.
Well, the sad thing is, it seems to me that what they're heading for is they're going to be caught. They're going to be the victim of a failing triangulation. That it seems that what they want and what they're asking for might actually happen under the guidance of the generals on the ground and the Republicans and the administration. And they're going to be forced into a position that they're just all they're going to be able to say is like, yep, that's exactly what should be happening. We should be have a drawdown by 2007. And they're not even going to have an edge on this. I don't want to politicize it, but I'm just being honest.
It should be politicized. It's a political issue.
But exactly.
It's perfectly fine to politicize it, but the way it should be politicized is, look, whatever the drawdown of troops is, whatever the withdrawal schedule, let's all agree.
The
policy failed. It was a bad idea in retrospect. Not all, and you don't have to get all caught up with, Valerie Plame or WMD, but basically it was one disastrous decision after another. It failed, and there need to be consequences for failure at the ballot box. But see, I think the Democrats have gotten out of the habit of accountability because they're so in bed with the teachers' unions, which are totally unaccountable, don't believe in accountability, that the whole notion of accountability has become foreign to a lot of Democrats. They have to get that back, because if they don't, they can't hold Bush accountable, and he deserves to be.
Now, you said the teachers' unions?
They're a disaster. They're a menace in American society.
And, well, what does that mean?
They're sort of like the religious right of the Democrats' version of the religious right.
Really? How so? I don't know about this.
Oh, you don't?
No.
Oh, gosh. Well, basically what's happened is that, our education system, our elementary and secondary education system are in crisis, particularly in inner cities, as you know. I mean, I heard a statistic today. They did a survey of Chicago students who entered as freshmen in high school in the early 1990s.
Uh-huh.
And they found out how many of them have now graduated from college, any college, junior college or four-year college, now, 15 years, almost 15 years later. Guess what the number is?
I have no idea.
6%.
Oh, my God.
So we have a failed situation.
A failed
totally
educational system.
Totally failed system. And the unions put the interests of, and I'm very, I'm very pro-teacher. I'm actually involved with an organization.
All right, Jonathan, you got to hold the thought.
Yeah.
Hold the thought. We got to take a break, but I'm looking forward to hearing this. I'm learning new things.
Okay.
We're on the phone with Jonathan Alter. We'll come back and we'll talk a little bit more about Democrats, Republicans, a little bit about FDR, and perhaps whatever else is on Jonathan Alter's mind. Stay with us.
Got an incubation period of over 60 years. Mark Maron.
Thanks, Jim. On the phone with us is Newsweek columnist Jonathan Alter, talking about politics. But right now we're talking about the teachers' union. Also, he's got a new book, The Defining Moment, FDR's Defining Moment and the Triumph of Hope, which we'll hopefully get into in just a minute. But now I'm learning new things because Jonathan has made a comparison to the religious right is to the Republicans as to the teachers' union is to the Democrats. And we're getting to the bottom of this. Let's finish it up then.
Okay. Basically, what you have is teachers' unions that are opposed to the idea of accountability. They don't want mayoral control because, in other words, what Daley did in Chicago and Bloomberg in New York and Menino in Boston and other cities, Democratic mayors, now Villagrosa wants to do it in L.A., teachers' unions don't want that because that means possibly less control for them. But mayoral control is essential to have some accountability. So if the schools are failing, people can take it out on the mayor. Same thing with control by principals. You have to have the principal control the building and determine what goes on in his and her or her building in order to have a good school. It's just elemental to having a good school. The teachers' unions don't want to give the principal the right to decide who can and can't teach in his or her school. They want to maintain that for them. So they're always putting the particular parochial interests of the teachers ahead of the students and the malpractice that is unfortunately being committed on many students. We need teachers to make more money. There's no question they need to make more money.
Yeah.
But they have to have more accountability, and the teachers' unions fight accountability every step of the way. They fight charter schools, which are some, not all are working, but many are terrific schools. They fight those every step of the way. So basically what's happened is that because there's such an important constituency in the Democratic Party, the whole party has been pulled away from this idea of accountability for performance. And the main problem, I argue, you know, in the country right now as a whole, is that Bush is not being held accountable for his pathetic performance. It's all about performance. One of the things that I write about in the book that made Franklin Roosevelt such a great president was that he put performance ahead of loyalty. Bush puts loyalty ahead of performance.
But
the teachers' unions put job security, protecting the weak links, protecting the bad teachers, ahead of their students, and accountability for performance. So in a nutshell, that's what's wrong with the teachers' union.
Okay, well, Jonathan Alter, let me shift back to Bush's accountability and the way that the government is structured now because of this administration, and possibly getting back to FDR, is that it seems to me, ultimately, aren't these guys going to have to pay at some point for privatizing everything? It's turning out that I don't know why we can't switch the cut and run frame onto them for what they did economically in Iraq. They basically used the U.S. government as a money laundering front to generate these no-bid contracts for work that was half done, poorly done. And the same with Katrina, the same situation, that this whole model of free market capitalism, this applied privatization of what the government should be doing, it falls victim to greed every time, and it doesn't function properly. When are they going to be accused of cut and run with taxpayers' money?
Well, I think that's a great point, and, you know, it's just part of the Iraq fiasco. They told us that the oil revenues were going to pay for the whole thing. It's costing $10 billion with a B dollars a month, the war is. But part of this is up to you. I don't mean to lay, and me. You know, basically what happens is when the pro-Bush forces come up with a slogan, it's repeated ad nauseum on talk radio. Cut and run, cut and run, cut and run.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you guys, really, you know, I'm not in the fray as much as you. I'm more of a, you know, standing back and, you know, at least sometimes criticizing Democrats pretty hard, too. But,
mm-hmm.
you know, if you're in the fray, you guys need to come up with some kind of a frame on this, you know, Iraq fiasco. Or Joe Biden tried the other day. He said the Republican Party is totally united in a failed policy.
That's pretty good.
He suggested that people say that over and over and over again. Then maybe at that point, failed policy will start to stick the way cut and run does, or Iraq fiasco will start to stick. But you guys are behind your conservative colleagues on talk radio in framing an issue and driving it home so people understand it, and it cuts through the clutter.
Well, you know, unfortunately, on the left, we have to go through several different committees of people who need to sort of assess whether the frame is effective, if it offends anybody.
Right, that does tend to happen, and that, you know, of course, that's just a recipe for being a wimpy opposition. You know,
yeah.
We need muscular liberalism.
Why wimpy?
You guys at Air America are beginning to provide some of it. But
yeah.
It's really in its nascent stages.
Well, why can't we? Why does it have to be wimpy? Why can't we be the thinkers, the deliberators, the people that are fair in their assessment of things?
Well, I'll tell you why. There's an old story involving Adlai Stevenson, who lost twice for president in the 1950s, and a woman came up to him and said, "Governor Stevenson, you have the vote of every thinking American." And Stevenson replied, "Well, that's nice, but I need a majority."
that's a fine story to bring up. Now, let's talk about just a couple other things I just want to get your read on. First, the Miami Seven, the seven clowns that wanted uniforms and tanks because they were starting a jihadi army. Was that political theater? Come on, you got to think on some level that Jeb delivered something to sort of embolden the "we're fighting the war on terror" frame. I mean, that was ridiculous.
I just don't have enough information to speculate that way about it. It may well be that, you know, local police, for whom victories in the war on terror are few and far between, you know, got maybe a little overexcited. But I still think it's better that those guys are off the street. I think it's really important that we go after the bad guys.
You know,
my problem, for instance, you know, has not on the FISA courts, you know, was not that people were being wiretapped who were suspected of being terrorists. It was that it was being done illegally. The idea of it being done with a court order, I'm fine with, you know, and I think we want more of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, the real problem is that the president shouldn't be able to just determine on a whim that he can tap everybody, right?
Right.
Yeah.
We have a 1978 law that governs this, and if they want to amend the law, then that should be debated.
Okay.
Just flout the law is ridiculous. And the way, Franklin Roosevelt didn't do that when he was president.
Well, I wish he could run for a fifth term. Or a fourth term. Didn't he do four? He did four, didn't he?
Well,
three
he
and
was
half.
Elected four times, but he died 2 months into his, 3 months into his fourth term.
Wow. So here we go. Let's talk about Portraits in Desperation. Rick Santorum's attempt to gain a few points in the polls by claiming that old rotting mustard gas canisters found on the border of Iraq and Iran where the WMDs were gunning for. How pathetic was that?
It was a really lame Hail Mary pass that fell incomplete. It did not score for him. He's 18 points down in Pennsylvania. This did not help him close the gap. I think that he was hoping, and I guess in some quarters, he got people to say, maybe there really were WMD there. And I got some nasty mail when I went on Keith Olbermann's show and ridiculed this whole thing. But generally speaking, even Fox wasn't buying it.
No one bought it. Yeah, you got nasty mail. See, that must be the 30% of the people that still believe in Bush. I mean, who the hell writes? What kind of mail? What'd they say to you?
But the 30%, that's, you know, it's very, very low for a president in terms of popularity, but it's still a lot of people.
Yeah, a lot of stupid people. I mean,
I don't say that about people.
No, I know.
I have friends who like Bush. I think that's the kind of thing that makes critics look like elitists. If we start to attack their intelligence or Bush's intelligence, it's just not productive. It's not helpful to
all right,
the
then
critics.
I'll do it. You know,
and
I
it's the
it.
Same thing. You know what really bugs me?
What?
Is when people say, I'm so upset with Bush, I'm thinking about moving to Canada. They're not really thinking about it, but they say it. You know, you hear that in liberal circles.
Yeah,
that drives me absolutely around the bend. Here we are trying to prove to people that, that we're as or more patriotic than they are.
Yeah.
And then
we're ready to leave.
Come along and they lose an election or they have a president who's a failure and all of a sudden they're talking about moving to Canada.
You know,
no, stay here and fight,
fight
our country.
You know what's funny about it is whenever you ask them where they're going to move, they always have an answer and it's always a nice place. You know what I mean? They're like, maybe Vancouver would be good. I was thinking maybe Paris would be nice for a few months.
Exactly. And that's the kind of thing that explains why Democrats and liberals are losing. Instead of saying, I might want to move to Canada, it should be, hell no, I'm going to stay here. I'm going to find that congressional race near my house. I'm not in that district, but where we can go and get the house back and get these toadies and incompetents out of office. Instead of doing that, they're talking about moving to Canada. It's not helpful.
Our guest is Jonathan Alter, Newsweek columnist, author of The Defining Moment, FDR's 100 Days and the Triumph of Hope. Quickly, at the end of this conversation we're having, is the midterm election all hinging on how we frame the Iraq War as Democrats?
I think it's extremely important that the debate that we have is about the single most important issue, which is war and peace, and that the war's been a failure. And if the Democrats try to run just on minimum wage or stem cells, which I personally think is a hugely important issue and should be part of the campaign, but it can't be on the long list of other Democratic issues, gas prices and this kind of thing. Those have to be secondary, and the primary issue has to be that President Bush and almost all of the Republicans have doubled down on a policy that has failed, and it's time to reevaluate the policy. And so people who want to hold the president accountable and move in a different direction, even if we don't know exactly what that direction is, they should vote Democratic. People who want to stay the course and have more of the same should vote Republican.
Thank you very much, Jonathan Alter. Good talking to you.
Thanks a lot.
You take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. We'll be back. I believe Mort Mortensen just walked in. I've got an American flag hanky for him. So that means I got to put education, health care, immigration on the back burner. It's all about the war, minimum wage, and stem cells. That's interesting. But we can't let him triangulate this one. I think he's right, and I think my idea is a bold idea. They got to come out there and do an Iraq report every week. Every week, a Democrat's got to say, look, this many people were died. This is why it's failing. Every week. We'll be back with Mark Mortensen.
He's ginning up the slime machine, Mark Maron.
Yeah, I am. I got to do a little research on the teachers' union. There were so many things I didn't know about. You know, in my head, it's just, it's always about teachers need more money. They should be paid much more money. They should be given everything they need in order to do their job properly. It's an important job. And he was talking about nuances in terms of the issue that I really didn't know about. And I'm sorry if I didn't represent some of your needs in that conversation, but I am a little at loss on the topic, and I will do my homework. Every week, folks, we reflect in our times of sorrow as we look back on the lives of the recently departed. Here now is grief correspondent Mort Mortensen with our weekly remembrance.
Oh, yeah.
Wow.
Ooh.
Big sigh.
Hey.
Yeah.
Hey.
Let it out. I got some American flag hankies for you.
Oh, thanks. Later, I don't
okay.
know.
Okay.
Harriet, the 176-year-old giant tortoise. Harriet, a 176-year-old tortoise believed to be one of the world's oldest living creatures, died of a heart attack last week after contemplating living another 80 years of his life, having to hear about Britney Spears' stupid children. Harriet was discovered by Charles Darwin and owned by crocodile hunter Steve Irwin, who through time specially adapted his traits as a crazed type A drunk into the career of a crazed type A drunk making millions yelling on a Jay Leno show.
Come on. Yeah.
Irwin said he considered Harriet a member of his family and could often be seen dangling her over a pit of crocodiles while feeding them live chickens. That's what he did.
Wow.
With his own kid.
That's ridiculous. That's horrendous.
Oh. Damn Logan berries.
Yeah, they're bad this year. Yeah. This time of year, very bad.
Congestion.
Yeah.
According to a local legend, the young Harriet was no bigger than a dinner plate when she was taken from the Galapagos and given to Queen Victoria for use as one of the world's first reusable diaphragms.
Oh, that's what they used for that then. Interesting.
Big woman, too.
Yeah.
Harriet is the second oldest tortoise ever authenticated. The oldest reportedly died in 1965 after being trampled at a Who concert.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
As a rock tortoise.
It's a rock tortoise.
Yeah.
Harriet requested that before she's gutted and stuffed, somebody at least scrape all those diaper marks off her shell from all those years spent at the petting zoo.
Oh, yeah. Diaper marks. What do they look like?
Petting zoo. You remember the little kids riding the big tortoise?
Oh, that's right.
You never went to one of those zoos?
Yeah, I went to the desert. Yeah.
Oh, man, I need a hanky.
Why don't you blow your nose into an American flag while you still can? Nice. Nice. You all right? Oh, that's good. Now I get it. Yeah.
Aaron Spelling, artist.
Mm-hmm.
Aaron Spelling, who was able to touch millions of Americans by tapping into their deepest inner loathing and then paying B actors to portray it on television, is canceled.
Done.
Done. It's over.
Yeah.
It's not going to be picked up.
The season's over.
Next week or year.
Yeah.
Whatever. Spelling reportedly died of a heart attack somewhere in his massive 123-room mansion after jokingly saying he was going to turn off all the lights.
Oh.
Yeah. It's a big place.
Yeah. Very big.
Spelling, who said the secret to his success was knowing just how much the average person loves to watch the insecurities and foibles of the wealthy, died last week while creating his newest project, Rich People Fart.
Oh, that's a guy. I heard about that show.
Yeah?
That's not going to happen now, I guess.
Foibles. Yeah. Right there is a foible. It may be picked up.
Foible.
Foibling.
Foible.
Foibling.
Yeah.
Spelling was associated with a dizzying roster of shows like Dynasty, The Love Boat, Fantasy Island, Charlie's Angels, Melrose Place, The Love Island, Charlie's Boat, Merrow's Hills, Boat Island, Love Hills, Dynasty Angels, and the ill-fated Manson's Ranch.
Oh, that would have been great.
Yeah.
A sitcom set at the Spawn Movie Ranch. We'll talk to our next guest about that in a little while when we get to Laurel Canyon.
Spawn Ranch is no longer there. I went there.
Did you?
Yeah, I tried to find it.
Nothing, huh?
Nothing.
No plaque?
No plaque, no nothing. Nothing to remember the old days by. Huh. I was very surprised by that. Manson wrote some good songs.
Sure.
Spelling requested that he be buried next to his daughter's original nose.
Woo, yeah.
Yeah, man. Hit the high mark at the end.
That's good, man. That's
yeah,
a good
got,
one.
She's got, okay.
Yeah.
This has been the week. This has been the weekly remembrance, Mark. Until next week, this is Mort Mortons saying, I got something in my heart.
This is a little squeaky, Mort. Thank you. That was very touching. Very touching. I tell you, I am pretty excited to talk to our next guest who's going to be on the phone. We've got two good guests coming. We've got Michael Walker, who wrote this amazing book about Laurel Canyon and all the freaks up there. And, you know, Zappa, the Birds, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, Joni Mitchell. Everyone used to hang out, sing songs, smoke dope, snort blow, and have sex. And it's really what defined the music industry.
Hippie Bill lived up there.
For a good 20 years. Yeah, Sweepy Bill Kolar lived up there. But apparently did not know anybody, was living in something that was a closet on stilts when he was like 20 years old. Actually, wait, it was 1970. So Bill was probably 40, and he lived there in that small place.
He told me, you know, one time he heard some screams coming up from one of the houses.
Yeah.
Should I go up there and check?
Nah. But the interesting thing about this, you know, let's not get into this book. The interesting thing is what a powerful epicenter Zappa's place was. Because Zappa's is sort of off the grid musically, but apparently a lot of, not off the grid, but he's not a pop musician per se. But he was always like a comics comic. He was a musician's musician. And it was like the hangout. And Manson used to run around up there, too.
Yeah, I know. That's
Manson was very popular for a while because, you know, he brought the drugs over and the cool chicks, man. And hey, Charlie's here with the girls who will do it for, you know, just anything, man.
And boys for Cary Grant. Isn't that the rumor?
Huh?
Boys for Cary Grant?
Did Charlie bring boys for Cary Grant?
I don't know.
I don't know if our guests can validate that. No, he has no idea about that kind of stuff. But you do have some Manson stuff for us, right? Got a little bit of Manson. Charlie was a very important. Charlie Manson was like a Cato Kalin gone wrong. You know, Charlie. There's always
like Cato Kalin went right.
Well, I mean, he'd end up becoming a cult leader because he wasn't that charismatic. But there's always been these characters in the history of Hollywood that ran in the dark places to supply the celebrities with their dark needs. They exist today, and they're always around. They're in guest houses. They're sweeping in cars, but they're always here. They feed on this place. But we're going to be talking about terrorists and insurgents and militias and clan warfare before we get into Laurel Canyon. So it's going to be a nice transition. Stay tuned with us. We're going to have Andrea Dew to talk about that stuff I just mentioned.
Now he's the main course at Nambia's world's largest barbecue, Mark Maron.
Thank you, Jim. I'm excited to have this conversation because I get a little obsessed with distinctions. And certainly when we talk about Iraq, it becomes hard to define the enemy. They are called insurgents. They fight militias. They are called terrorists. The bottom line is that the type of war that is being fought is against a foe that is not necessarily new, but certainly different than what the definition of war through the centuries has prepared the modern military for. Here to define the distinction between these new antagonists and fighting units and talk about how it is different and why they can be successful is the co-author of Insurgents, Terrorists, and Militias, The Warriors of Contemporary Combat, Andrea Dew. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Mark. Thanks so much for having me on.
You bet. So now, in your book, you call the combatants of the new warfare non-state actors. I know that seems self-explanatory, but will you define it for me?
Absolutely. What we're looking at is sort of the opposite of states, the opposite of conventional militaries. These are groups that are not sponsored by the state. They're internal, mm-hmm. And we define them in several different categories, insurgents, terrorists, and militias.
Now, this phenomenon, this type of combatant is not new per se. I mean, there's been guerrilla wars, there's been clan conflicts. They've been around since the beginning of human beings, I imagine, yeah?
Yes, absolutely, yes.
And you define these in relations to what modern warfare is and how it is sometimes, has a very difficult time against these type of combatants. Why is that?
Well, this is a really good question. Conventional militaries are set up to assess other conventional militaries. So if you think back to the Cold War, the U.S. had, you know, pretty much had all the playbooks of the Soviet military.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they knew what all the units were called. They knew what the uniforms were. They knew what the history of these units were. But the problem is with sort of non-state actors, these irregular militaries, is they don't put their doctrine out on the Internet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they don't publish and say, well, we're going to march in formation drill, and these are our skills, and these are the things we're really good at. And the conventional militaries have sort of missed the boat on this because, you know, they're used to looking at, you know, other armed forces that are conventional. They're looking for tanks. They're looking for airplanes. And that's not the way that these people fight.
Yeah, and certainly they're not necessarily until recently looking for people that are willing to die in the sense of using themselves as weapons.
Yeah, I mean, that's a shift in motivations, even within these groups.
Yeah, now let's talk about the groups you discuss in the books separately so we can understand, because it seems to me that in Iraq, we're dealing at least with three of the groups you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely.
You talk about insurgents, terrorists, militias, criminal organizations. Now, and there is a difference between the four.
Yeah, there is. You know, it depends. It's to do with your tactics. It's to do with your motivation.
Right,
you know?
Insurgents, for instance.
They are fighting for, they're fighting, this is a good question, they're fighting against and they're fighting for.
Mm-hmm.
So in the case of Iraq, I mean, we have some very specific names for these groups.
Mm-hmm.
There's a group called the Sunni Arab Rejectionists.
Mm-hmm.
And you're familiar with the Sunni triangle, you know, Fallujah,
sure.
Crete.
Yeah.
The Sunni Arab Rejectionists come from that area, and they're basically saying, we reject anything that the United States is trying to provide.
Okay, so they are an extreme nationalist operation.
They're an extreme operation, yes. And they're not, you know, when you go back to guerrilla warfare, you have this idea of revolution, that they're trying to provide a new political formation. The Sunni Arab Rejectionists are not trying to provide anything new. They're just saying, we want it as it was before.
Okay, I got it. So now, and then the difference between that and a terrorist, I'm assuming, is that a terrorist can operate without an ideology, per se, even.
Yeah, terrorism, we tend to focus more on tactics.
Mm-hmm.
Terror is a tactic. It's the idea of you use terror, you use beheadings, you use explosions as a way of making a political point.
Okay, so that's a tactic. Now, militias, now insurgents can operate in militias, yes?
Absolutely, yes. Yeah.
Okay. Now, let's talk a little bit about what you talk about in the book a lot, and in terms of clan warfare and in terms of one of the great liabilities for the U.S. military in Iraq has been the fact that they did not, all the way up to the top, all the way up to Rumsfeld, to Bush, did not assess the tribal loyalty of some clans and the conflicts within those clans that pre-existed this war probably by hundreds of years, and the momentum of that.
Yeah, that's exactly what we argue. This idea that there's history. There's history of the way that Iraqis fight. And one of the things that Iraqis have traditionally fought for is they fought against occupation.
Mm-hmm.
They fought against invasion.
Mm-hmm.
And it's one of those sort of central tenets of warfare that goes back hundreds and hundreds of years. And it goes through all of the tribal, you know, the stories in tribes about, you know, what it is to be a brave warrior. And one of the stories is what it is to be a brave warrior, somebody who stands up against
right.
the invading forces.
Yeah. Now, so, but basically the prognosis for a situation like this is that there's really no end to it as long as generations continue to be born and as long as that there are people that think along these lines.
Well, you know, the tribal way of warfare perpetuates, but the situation in Iraq, I think, is very specific. If you break it out into the various groups that are involved, you know, there's ways of sort of picking off or, you know, bringing in some of those groups into the future of Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
Some of those groups, however, are just, you know, the rejectionists, the people who say, we want Saddam Hussein back.
Well, it's interesting because when I've talked to journalists over there, Mick Ware in particular, back when, he said that there was a big turn of events when the people that you're talking about began to volunteer for suicide missions. These were non-jihadists fighters who I assume were rejectionists who just out of despair and anger began to use themselves as bombs, which I think is a complete turn in thinking in terms of fighting this kind of combatant.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, one of the themes that we pick up on in the book is, you know, there are traditional ways of fighting, and those have limits.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you don't pick on non-combatants. You don't kill women and children. You don't use mosques.
Mm-hmm.
And what we've seen, particularly in Iraq, is this kind of morphing of these sort of from very extreme groups. They've become, these tactics have become more mainstream.
And sadly, in terms of tribal loyalties and affiliations, that the more evil the enemy becomes, the more emboldened their message and mythology becomes.
I think you hit it right on the head there. I mean, you know, if tribal warfare says, you know, it's your duty and it's your right, and that, you know, this makes you a stand-up member of the clan, of the family, if you stand up against these invading forces, you know, as long as the invading forces are still there, then you still have a reason to do what you do.
So now, what would you recommend in terms of the studies you've done? I mean, how can the U.S. military, the U.S. government, deal with this in a way that might achieve some success, which we're not seeing?
Well, I think we're not seeing it here, but I think that the U.S. military has done a pretty good job cluing into this at the micro level, you know, the sort of the boots on the ground level. What we've seen is a quite remarkable transition in terms of understanding the situation. You know, when you get down to the U.S. Marine Corps, for example, the reserves, the National Guard that are there, I think they've really started to get to grips at a local level with who these people are and how to, you know, sort of reassure, for example, the Sunnis.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you go into the Sunni triangle, it's about saying to people, well, maybe we'll get you the electricity. You know, it used to be on 12 hours a day under Saddam Hussein's reign. You know, we cut it down to 3 hours a day just after the end of Operation Enduring Freedom. Maybe it's about little things like getting that back up to 12 hours a day again, you know, providing services, raising up the standard of living and saying, you know, there is hope and there's something to look forward to.
Right. But in terms of the argument you make in light of the rejectionists, it seems that there is still because, you know, four soldiers were killed over the last 2 days, American soldiers, and the death toll of Iraqis is insane. It seems to me that there is a large contingent within the insurgency that is not going to stop until the Americans are gone.
I mean, that's the hard thing. You know, how do you get to the point where Iraq is actually taking responsibility for itself, and Iraq starts to, you know, the Iraqi politicians and the Iraqi people start to deal with some of these issues that are internal.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens. Andrea Du, I appreciate your book. I appreciate the information you share with us. I hope you have a good day.
Thank you so much for having me.
You bet. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Okay, we're going to be back to talk about sex, drugs, and music in California, man. We can make this shift, dude. There's a break. They're going to sell some Hondas, and we'll come back with Michael Walker and talk about Laurel Canyon. Stay with us. All right, here's a couple of surprising factoids. Laurel Canyon used to be a cheap place to live. And in the late 60s, Frank Zappa's cabin was the musical epicenter of a community that included Joni Mitchell, The Byrds, Jim Morrison, Buffalo Springfield, and later evolved groups like the Eagles, Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. It was also the on-the-road hang of Eric Clapton, Led Zeppelin, and the scene was basically a petri dish for the singer-songwriter mold and helped define that genre as well as rock and roll at that time. With us now is the author of Laurel Canyon, the inside story of rock and roll's legendary neighborhood, Michael Walker. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
It's good to see you, man. So you live up there now?
I do, yeah.
And what was it, the history that brought you there?
No, I was coming from New York, and I was supposed to have a house all lined up, and it fell through the day I got and had to fly back the next day, and so a realtor just took me up into the canyon, and I rented the first house I saw, which turned out to be like about maybe two blocks from where John Mayall, who was the last of the 60s guys, was still living up there.
John Mayall, Mr. Blues, man. John Mayall spawned all the guys. Spawned Peter Green, Fleetwood Mac, Eric Clapton. He was the dude, man.
Well, it's like a finishing school if you were like a hot guitar player. Mick Taylor from the Rolling Stones.
Mick Taylor,
school,
right?
You know, all of those bands. But his house burned in this terrible fire in 1979, took out the whole of Grandview Drive, where I used to live, and part of Colcrest Drive. And his house went down with everybody else's. I think it was along the lines of 36 houses. It was one of those Santa Ana fires. And then,
I was told that if you actually inhaled the smoke deeply, you'd get a buzz. Is that true?
Probably.
So let's start at the beginning of the history. But more importantly, so you're not renting. You bought a place up there eventually?
Yes, I did.
And it's not a cheap place to live anymore.
No, it is not a cheap place at all. It's the same problem is, you know, pretty much taken over all of Los Angeles.
Sure.
It's just taken over that as well.
And who lives up there now?
It's none of the old gang from Jeff Emmerich, the Beatles engineer, lives there.
We were just talking about him, the guy who engineered Revolver.
Yeah, he lives up there. Sally Kellerman lives up there.
Okay.
The actress.
She's funny.
So there's a few people left, celebrities, and there's some younger actors and musicians that live
who
there.
Cares?
Who cares, right?
Yeah, it's not the same anymore, is
but
it?
But the old gang is gone. Joni Mitchell still owns her house. Well, apparently still owns her house there.
Oh, really?
Yeah, she's been there for years.
So what year are we talking about when the community started to blossom?
Starts about 1965.
With who?
Arthur Lee of Love always claimed he was the first one.
I don't get that guy. But go ahead. You go.
Yeah, but he was apparently one of the first ones. My book starts with Chris Hillman from the Byrds standing looking at for rent sign at a telephone pole in front of the Canyon store.
And that 69?
That was 64.
64?
Yeah.
So the Byrds were there before Arthur Lee.
Arthur always claims he was there before everybody, so we'll just have to give it up to Arthur.
He makes a few claims. I mean, I don't want to digress, but I have tried to understand the appeal of that guy and that record, and I don't get it.
What a record?
Love?
Love. They made tons of records.
Yeah, but they...
Great group.
No.
Jim Morrison influenced, or vice versa.
That doesn't justify him to me. I can't understand. I can't wrap my brain around it. It's silly to me, some of it. Anyways, we don't need to do this now. So the Byrds are up there.
Yeah, Roger McGuinn moved in after Chris Hillman, and then it just sort of cascaded after that. If you didn't live there, you might as well live there. I mean, David Crosby, I don't think, ever actually lived in Laurel Canyon. He lived in, I think, Beverly Glen. But people just would, you know, hang out on each other's floors and things like that.
Okay, so as early as 64, you've got the Byrds, and that includes David Crosby and Graham Nash at that time?
Graham Nash, no, he moved in.
From the Hollies. He was in the Hollies.
He moved in a few years later. He moved into Joni Mitchell's house on Lookout Mountain.
So Joni Mitchell had two houses up there?
She had one.
He was living with Joni?
Yeah. They lived. That's what the song Our House is written about, so the house they shared together.
Oh, wait. So Joni and Graham were doing it? They were a couple?
They were, in fact, a couple, yes. She had been a couple with David Crosby before, and then she became a couple with Graham Nash.
Wow. That's like the yin and the yang. Man, dude. Wow. It's like, you know, I've had enough of him. Bring in the wuss. But anyway. I'm not, you know, no judgment. I just, you know, Graham Nash on his own, whatever the case. But so that's where it goes. And then when does Morrison come in and Zappa the interesting thing about this is I know Moon Zappa and I know these kids that grew up in there, and I knew I had been told about Zappa's cabin and I'd been told that everybody hung out there, but I can't seem to hook, like, I can't see Crosby and Zappa hanging out together.
I don't know how much David Crosby, if ever, hung out of the Zappa cabin. The Zappa cabin only existed, he lived there for 4 months in 1968. Gail Zappa came back, had been in New York.
They've got two houses up there now, don't they?
Yeah, well, yeah. The Zappa cabin was originally built in the early part of the 20th century.
Uh-huh.
Tom Mix, the silent movie star, lived there, buried his horse underneath the... There was a bowling alley downstairs. It was a tavern called the Laurel Tavern.
By
the time Gail Zappa rented it, it was just sort of a derelict property.
Yeah.
So he moves in, and for like four to 6 months, it just became the place in the canyon. Everybody, because it sat right on Laurel Canyon Boulevard. It was so close to the front door, practically opened onto the street.
Okay.
You know, but it was this huge. It was a big place. The GTOs were born there. Alice Cooper was signed in that structure, probably. I mean, it was this place where Mick Jagger and Marianne Faithfull would come up to visit. So it became quite the place to go.
So it was like a party atmosphere, because Frank, you know, outside of, he was not, like, I kind of see like Joni Mitchell and David Crosby. He's being kind of lofty in a way and kind of maybe a little snobby, but like Zappa was such a goofball. It must have been just a nonstop freak show.
Well, yeah, I think it's probably what drove him from the place, because Gail Zappa, his wife, told me that eventually there were no locks on the doors of this place.
in these
buses of rock and roll guys from like Ohio would roll into town and say, oh, let's go to Frank's house.
Let's see, Yeah, right.
So these guys would show up at 3 in the morning, and she'd have to deal with them. So,
Frank, where's Frank?
Yeah, where's Frank?
Speed Freak showing up going, we got some stuff.
Yeah, and Frank was completely straight. He didn't drugs or I don't think he even drank. And so it was this weird dichotomy of people getting high before they would go into the house. He just wouldn't allow it.
He smoked a lot of cigarettes, though.
A lot of espressos, but he had a big work ethic, so you had to work hard to be.
No kidding. That's why he's Zappa, and he's got, the weird thing about Zappa is, like, you know, he's got hundreds of records out.
The discography just, like, you know, goes on. And
yeah,
on.
It's unbelievable. It's a whole section. All right, so we're going to continue talking. We're running out of time in this segment, but I'd like to know a little bit about, you know, where it went bad. I'd like to know when Jim Morrison came and the music shifted, and also the alliance. It was really the first time that record execs kind of hung with the artists as equals, and I don't know if that was genuine or not, but it was certainly the birth of David Geffen and a couple of other big execs who kind of hung out and acted like their friends, and I'd like to know if they really thought that they were their friends, ultimately. We're talking to Michael Walker. The book is Laurel Canyon, The Inside Story of Rock and Roll's Legendary Neighborhood.
Just burned his freak flag, Mark Maron.
I've burned flags all day today. Do it while you can, people. You're going to take that freedom away from us. Our guest is Michael Walker. The book is Laurel Canyon, The Inside Story of Rock and Roll's Legendary Neighborhood. On the break, we were talking about just the amazingly large Zappa catalog. I tend to, you know, plug into Joe's Garage occasionally.
Yeah.
I like it. That came out when I was in high school, and I had a friend who was a Zappa freak. But we're talking about Laurel Canyon. We're talking about... So what happens in the late 60s is Morrison comes in, Crosby's hanging around, Clapton's hanging around here and there. Mayall lived, when did he come in?
He came in around 68, I think, 69.
Mayall's one of these, like, great, he's a respected guy, but never really got his due, I don't think.
He never got his due commercially in the United States, but I think worldwide he's probably just fine. But he mentored an awful lot of, you know, very
great players.
Clapton, Mick Taylor, and on and on and on.
And what about the Brits? Zeppelin. I mean, I know that the groupie scene, Laurel Canyon was known for having a nice place to get laid if necessary. And the Hyatt down on Sunset.
Yeah, well, there was a codependency between the Hyatt and Sunset and Laurel Canyon and the musicians therein. Until the Manson murders, when it became evidence that Charles Manson, who a lot of people had seen kind of floating in and out of parties in the canyon, they were probably selling.
There's Charlie! Charlie's here with the acid!
Yeah. Well, when that happened, when people figured out what was going on, and he was arrested, and they realized what he probably had done, a lot of the bands would rent houses in Laurel Canyon when they were recording or when they were on tour. Sometimes they had a few days in L.A. Then everybody went down to the Chateau Marmont and the Hyde House forever after that. That was the end of renting houses because they were too scared.
So Manson killed it. He helped bring the 60s to a close in terms of what it represented.
Well, people in Laurel Canyon
until
those murders happened, hitchhiked everywhere and doors were left open. And it was very much an open society. And that really put the fear of whomever into them because it realized, here's a guy that looks just like you. But everyone belong here isn't necessarily your friend all of a sudden.
They
can be jerks, too.
And the drugs got bad, I guess. So what killed it up there as well? Blow, right? It wasn't speed as well, or no?
That was the main drug that everyone I talked to said did everything in was cocaine. And that came in as early as in 69, before Crosby, Stills, and Nash. David Crosby and Stephen Stills were shopping an acetate of some early Crosby, Stills, and Nash song. And so they... just to hide their identities, they called themselves the Frozen Noses. So it'll give you an idea that that was already there, but it really blossomed in the early 70s with the rise of singer-songwriters and that whole crowd. And it became like currency. It was just like, one woman told me she worked for one of the record companies. Her job was to, she knew a photographer who was also a dealer, and the guy was supposed to buy an ounce at the show, and she would call him the next morning and say, okay, I need an ounce from pictures from backstage last night and an ounce. He'd deliver the ounce of coke to this label. She would then cut it up into grams for all the executives. I mean, one guy was doing an interview at A&M Records for a job, and the guy, you know, cut some lines and just offered them right in the middle of the interview.
I remember when it was almost not inappropriate to pull it out at a dinner table after dinner.
Well, apparently it's becoming that way again. But
really?
Yeah, that's so I gather in the
I did a lot of that stuff, and the thought of of doing it again. It's like, it's great for a couple hours, but what do you do with the other 60? You know, you know what I mean? I just never, if people can handle it, so be it. But now let's talk about this alignment. That you're talking in the early 70s. That's after Morrison goes. That's after the Byrds. That's mm-hmm. after Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Younger. So they're still there. But really, what came out of that were the Eagles. Mm-hmm. And who else?
Well, it was the Eagles. It was Jackson Browne. It was Joni Mitchell. Then had her really, really big records in the 70s.
Really?
Yeah. Linda Ronstadt, who didn't live in Laurel Canyon, but she was part of this L.A. singer-songwriter thing. But what happened was these people got really good managers. A lot of the early 60s guys got screwed. They had managers that weren't from their generation. What these guys got were they got Elliot Roberts, and they got David Geffen, and they got John Hartman.
These so they got the same – what was going on in the movies was a similar thing too,
yeah.
right? I mean, because you had like, you know, Scorsese and those cats were hanging out somewhere up in there, I think, as well, doing the blow mm-hmm. and talking it up. And the executives started to change around this time in both the music business
right.
and the film industry because the old guys didn't know how to sell to the new kids.
So they didn't get it. If you were a guy like David – David Geffen and Elliot Roberts had both
yeah.
started. They were working in the mailroom with William Morris in New York, and they moved to L.A. They knew the business side, but they also were young, so they looked like these people. There's a
right.
picture in my book of Stephen Stills, Neil Young, and Elliot Roberts sitting on stage before a concert. And if you didn't know who these guys were, you would assume that Stephen Stills was the manager. I mean, he looks the straightest one of the bunch.
And there's some shots of Geffen during the Deja Vu from the Deja Vu photo shoot.
Yeah.
That it's the same thing. He's a little bearded hippie guy.
Yeah. You would never know. But these guys were ruthless. They were really tough businessmen, and they never cheated their artists. They ended up all suing each other later anyway for other reasons. But a lot of money was suddenly being made. That they were making the scope of the money blew up almost overnight in the 70s into something huge, and that's when people started paying attention.
The new music, that's when the movement got kind of recycled into the fashion, and everybody
Precisely.
Could they made hits out of these guys. Now, what about the triumvirate of Hendrix, Joplin, and Jim Morrison? Was there a time when the three of them were ever up there?
Well, there was
outside of Morrison.
There was a guy that lived behind the Canyon store, and there was a house where Morrison's, like, you got to realize Jim Morrison domiciles to Laurel Canyon, like bars that Hemingway drank in Key West. Everybody thinks Jim Morrison lived in their house, but he apparently really did live in this place behind the Canyon store. And the guy that lived there made this totem pole, and on the likenesses on the totem pole were Joplin, Hendrix, and Morrison. And when the guy moved, he took it with him and ran right to the middle of his house.
Oh, really?
So they got together on that totem pole. I don't know if the three of them ever commingled in
right.
one room. Morrison was in and out of. He used to sleep at the Alta Cienega Motel down in Santa Monica.
Yeah.
He had a lot of places to crash. I don't know if he was an official member of
now,
the Canyon.
That store is still there, yeah?
Oh, the Canyon store, definitely, yeah.
And that was sort of like Grand Central for the Canyon community.
Yeah, Michael DeBarra, who lived there in the 70s with Miss Pamela, the famous GTO group, he said
yeah.
it was like the lobby of the Laurel Canyon Hotel, which
uh-huh.
I thought was a great description because
uh-huh.
it's a great place to come down and get some coffee, catch up with all the dealers, because that was also where everybody bought their drugs.
Yeah.
In the
yeah.
parking lot.
Sure. So in retrospect, in terms of your research, who were the biggest egos on the mountain? Who were the kings of the mountain?
Well, I don't know about the egos. The queen of the mountain was Mama Cass Elliott, and people loved her. And her house up on Woodrow Wilson Drive was like this salon. Everybody came to her house.
Really?
That's what surprised me, that she really was. She pretty much dragooned Crosby, Stills, and Nash into playing together for the first time.
She's like a musical Yenta.
Yeah. She would have made a great artist manager, but she also knew the music and she could sing really well. But everybody loved her.
Would just come and hang, and she was, I guess maybe she actually was kind of mama-like. Maybe
oh, yeah.
she was very nurturing and come hang out, I'll make you some food.
Oh, yeah, she always had a lot of food around. David, or Graham Nash told me that he said he always remembers there was this great big chicken, and she had all these little troublesome chicks that she had to keep, you know, this one talking. She knew everybody's business. She was a real pot stirrer.
So she was that's funny, because she was a real Laurel Canyon kind of gossipy Yenta.
Oh,
like,
yeah, precisely, know. Yeah. She was, if some musician came to town and was on a TV show and didn't know where to hang, she would find him and bring him up and have a party for him. You know,
now, and also, yeah, and you also feature Rodney
Bingenheimer.
Yeah, Bingenheimer in the book, and you can see him almost any night at Cantor's in his booth.
He still hangs.
And I had no idea that he really facilitated as early as the early 70s the entree of the British rockers into this community.
Oh, all those glam guys. I mean, David Bowie owes him a big debt, because he personally took David Bowie around. Nobody cared about David Bowie, and introduced him to the record business in Los Angeles. He had great taste. He knew, and he did it again with the the bands in the 80s. He really, really was an integral part of the LA music scene.
And there was a place where the Brits would all hang out and engage with their groupies. It was a tavern that Rodney actually owned?
There was, yeah. It was Bingenheimer's, and it was down, originally was in the space where the Bar Marmont is, or was, and I think that's even closed now. Mm-hmm. But they moved way down off the strip. I can't remember the intersection. It was on Sunset, though. But yeah, there was the two stations of the cross where was the Rainbow, where Led Zeppelin and everybody hung up, but they also would hang out at Bingenheimer's at the other end of the strip.
It's weird, because I was hanging out once or twice at the Rainbow in, I guess, the early 80s when I was a doorman at the Comedy Store, and the metal scene was still predominant over there. And mm-hmm. it was a drug pit then. You know, it was a kind of a scary place to go. But, you know, just in terms of, it was just a little bit of a drug pit, but decent spaghetti. Yeah, that's weird about some of these drugier hangouts like Barney's Beanery is that you could always get carved up. Do you know what I mean? If you've been on a 3-day bender and you haven't eaten, maybe you could go load up first before you refuel. So now, in terms of, you know, writing the book and thinking about it nostalgically or even historically, It seems to me that L.A. had obviously, not unlike everywhere else, had a lot more character and a lot more authenticity and a lot more community than it does now, just in terms of the what the Strip represented and what the Hyatt represented and what the Laurel Canyon represented, and all that is really gone.
Yeah, it's too bad, because I think part of what's killed it off is technology. And also, one of the reasons this scene flourished is it was cheap to live there in the mid-60s. You could rent a place for a couple $100 and stuff it with all of your friends. And,
yeah.
You know, and there was no cell phones. There was no answering machines. There was no internet. There was no text messaging. And it forced being, most of these people didn't have cars. They were all broke. Most of them were failed folk musicians. They'd come to L.A. as, like, to make their last stand. And because they lived on top of each other in this canyon, like Lookout Mountain is incredibly chock-a-block, very houses right next to each other. They were out hitchhiking everywhere, and they would run into each other all the time. And I know people in retrospect say it was such a great time to be there because you really felt you were in the right place at the right time.
Yeah.
You were young, and you were with these very talented people making great music. So yeah, it's too bad that it doesn't exist now.
Yeah, I started to think that type of musical interaction doesn't happen anymore. But I think it does.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't think it surfaces or it is as intimate as it once was.
Yeah, you can't. It's hard to get people who are broke together in a city anymore, where they can have actually make a community like that. It's done online more now. It's done via MySpace. It's done a lot of otherwise.
Jim, any closing questions on your mind? Anything you want to ask our guest?
Arthur Lee, is he still around?
Yeah, he's still around.
I heard he was in jail for a while, but then he got out.
I've tried, you know, and I'm not dismissing that record because I've bought it 3 times, and I try to listen to it and enjoy it. I'm talking about the first one. Mm-hmm. That was reissued and has a symphony accompaniment, and I'm not disregarding the fact that the guy is obviously has some genius to him. It's difficult music for me to wrap my mind around.
Brilliant melodies in there, you know.
I guess.
Yeah, it was like they used to play at a place, I think it was called Bino Litos. It was way down in Hollywood off the strip, and it was a very dynamic. First of all, it was a racially integrated band. There weren't a lot of those back then. And Arthur would perform like with one boot off, and
he's a little nutty.
I can't speak for creative genius, I guess.
Okay, well, Michael Walker, thank you for writing the book. The book is Laurel Canyon: The Inside Story of Rock and Roll's Legendary Neighborhood. It was great talking to you.
Great, thanks.
Maybe
thanks.
I'll see you around. Great. We will come back and do some jokes and. All right, Lizard King. I bet you don't like him, do you, Jim?
I'm sure I do.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
That's interesting. That's interesting.
If I like Arthur Lee, I love the Lizard King.
Huh. But not Led Zeppelin.
Oh, yeah.
Talking to his agent has tweaked his brain cortex, Mark Maron.
I think I've talked to my agent twice.
In 3 years?
Ever. I have a relatively new agent. But no, that's not true. Not the the hosting one I've talked to a lot recently, but the theatrical one, not so much. Yes, I'm with a large agency.
Do you have literary agent as well?
I could probably get one of them.
And movie agent?
The movie would be theatrical, I think, yeah.
Movie theatrical?
Yeah, I'm with the ICM, so that means I'm fortified with many. Many will work for me if... But they haven't really that much, except my hosting agent's done some real work for me.
You're with ICM, huh?
Just recently.
I'm with them.
Yeah, I hear they're very good, and I'm proud of you. That's not easy to get with them.
They're everywhere.
Yeah, yeah. No, they are everywhere and all encompassing.
Right.
No, I don't know. You know, I talk to my management a lot more than I do my agent, and but my lawyer I haven't talked to recently. See, there's a lot of people that are around.
why can't one person do all those things?
It's not the way company. You can when you get to a certain level. You can actually, I think, function with a lawyer and a publicist if you are a known commodity. But it's the way the business is designed, so everybody gets their piece. I didn't talk about this, but I'm going to be doing this live version of What's My Line. You know the old TV show?
Yes.
They do it live here at the Acme Theater down in La Brea tomorrow night. Wednesday night at 8 o'clock. I'll put it up on the website for my LA people. It sounds kind of interesting. I had to watch the show again to see how to do it. I'm going to go to rehearsal tonight. That should be kind of fun. I'm also at the Improv tomorrow night. I should put these up on the website.
Are you one of the guests or one of the panel?
No, I'm on the panel. Also, Michael just told me that you can go to laurelcanyonthebook.com. That he upstates it. He Albanies it every once in a while. It's fun, apparently. I'll put it on my website by the time you hear this coming out of your speaker. Also, the Democracy Fest down in San Diego. That's the weekend of, man, when is that, Jim?
14th and the 15th, Mark.
14th and the 15th
of July.
We're going to be doing the show live down there on the 14th. That should be fun. Howard Dean's going to be there. Al Franken's going to be there. I think people from up here in Los Angeles should go down there and have a party, man. David Sirota is going to be there. Robert Greenwald. All the big stars, celebrities.
I hear the Democracy may show up. I'm not sure about
that. Yeah, man. What else was I going to say? Tomorrow we have a lovely show. So, Jim, you okay, man? Everything good?
I'm okay.
You all right?
You know, I'm going all right. Why? Were you bringing up something? Are you pointing? What are you doing? What do you mean by that?
I'm taking a deep breath. We're getting older. I can't afford the energy that you're trying to rile up in me right now. I'm just
trying to make some energy here.
I had a nice groove going, man. We were talking about Laurel Canyon. We were reflecting. I'm thinking about going home and playing some guitar. Oh, yeah. What about this? Where is the drop-off for you? You can like Jim Morrison, but you can't like... What about Hendrix? Do you like Hendrix?
Wait, you're not for a second comparing Jim Morrison and his band to Led Zeppelin. I mean, they're completely different categories, in my opinion.
They're both great bands.
Whereas Arthur Lee and Jim Morrison are like one and the same in their poetic ramblings and stuff, and the musical style.
But I'm just trying to. Something. Do you like Hendrix? You probably don't, right?
Oh yeah, I do.
You like Hendrix?
Of course, yeah. Great. What, do you play guitar? Yeah, guitarist. He's a great guitarist.
The reason I think I have a problem with Arthur Lee is just that it's a type of orchestrated psychedelia that I just didn't dig. It sounded goofy to me. It just sounds a little goofy.
Well, he influenced Hendrix, to my knowledge, a lot. You know, and yeah, it sounds kind of like a very produced Beatlesque. Psychedelic. I mean, the leads do,
but they're not certainly not as hooky or as poppy, and even Jim Morrison. As much as I love him, some of that sounds goofy to me. Got to be honest with you.
Well, I agree. I mean, there's the best parts of it, and you just throw away the scraps.
Yeah, I just don't understand. All right, we're cool. Let's do this now. We don't want you to be uninformed or left out of the loop or however you want to look at it. Here's your short order news for today. Rush Limbaugh could see a deal with prosecutors in a long-running prescription fraud case collapse after authorities found a bottle of Viagra in his bag at Palm Beach International Airport. The prescription was not in his name. The prescription had Limbaugh's doctor's name on it instead of his own for the sake of privacy and to create the impression that Limbaugh just happened to be carrying around another man's Viagra. That stuff's scary. Done it a couple times. It's scary. You're like, what do I do with it now? What do we do with it now? You're not going to sleep. What happens now?
I'm on it right now.
Why? One day, one of the Andy...
Thought I might need it.
One of Andy Warhol's trademark silver wigs sold for $10,800 at Christie's Auction House last week. always a trendsetter, the sales marks the beginning of the dead artist cosmetic prosthetic movement. Similar pieces include Basquiat's rubber pecs and Jackson Pollock's crotch sock. Whatever, dude. I'm going to let it go. I had to pick one, didn't I? All right. The annual cost of replacing, repairing, and upgrading army equipment in Iraq and Afghanistan is expected to more than triple next year to more than $17 billion. The latest cost includes transferring over 2,000 trucks and Humvees to the Iraqi security forces, who find the vehicles ideal for retreating. Over half of that $17 billion will be spent on spinners for the Humvees. It's spinning, man. Great Chris Rock joke. Tomorrow, Amy Sedaris, Paul Dinello will be here from the Stranger with Candy movie, which I watched last night. And she's very funny, very talented, had a lot of big stars in it. Colbert co-wrote it, but we'll talk about it. All in all, maybe I didn't understand it. John Amato will be from crooksandliars.com will be on tomorrow. And Brad Friedman from Brad Blog will be here to talk intensely and endlessly.
Brad Blog.
About election fraud. So come back for that. Good night, sheeple. This is the end.